For millions of years, your destiny has been carefully formed, bringing you to this moment of living on purpose.
Okay, my name is Ted Farrer. I used to live in London during the bombing raids. I was only, 12 years old in 1940, when the Battle of Britain was all on. When the air raids would go, we would automatically be running off down to the air raid shelters, which was at the top of the road. In 1940, I was living with my gran. After we used to have our supper, which would be around 5 o'clock, and then we would pack up all our little value bits and we'd head off up to the air raid shelters, which we would spend the full night there. Everybody had their own little sleeping areas, which you went to every night, so nobody would take your bunk. My gran would have the lower part, I would be up on top. But that was our regular night to night while the raids were going on, up to the air raid shelters, and we have to wait until the morning and find out what street got it, what houses were still standing, or what friends we'd lost. When the war started, I was only, 10, or just turned 10. When the bombing started bad in England, I went out with the thousands of other little kids that went off evacuated. My brothers and sisters all went different places. Two went to Cornwall, down to St. Ives. I was sent out to a little place called Marlow, which was just outside London, which I hated. And because the people I was living with, he worked on the farm as a farmer, and decided that as a 10-year-old, he could go and plant cabbages and dig up potatoes, which my father didn't take too much liking to that. If you can do that there, he says, you might as well come back home and work back home. Well, I never saw any schooling after the age of 10. My schooling was finished. I lost track of members of my own family for years and years, because when the bombing got real bad and families started to move out of London, my mother was sent way up into Leicestershire, a place called Melton Mowbray, where she took all the younger ones, because I am second oldest of 11. Yeah, we all kind of got spread over all different places. In fact, it was only this year that I just returned back from England. I came into Canada in 1967. I was married at 19 and went off to Surrey, Virginia Waters, Surrey. And I don't know, every members of the family at that time kind of took off and went their own way and did their own thing. There was an article in the paper about it just recently in the news, stating where I went back and met members of my family after all these years. But I didn't lose anybody, close members, during the war. Well, I went round all the regular haunts as I used to be as a kid, but everything had changed. I hardly recognised anything. The streets that I used to play around as a kid were gone. All there were now was great big office high-rise buildings. The street where my gran and I lived for a number of the years of the war was still there, but it was hard to recognise anything. I suppose after all these years, you know, you have pictures in your mind, but they don't always tally when you start looking back at them. When I was living with my gran, my father was there too, because he used to work at the West India Docks, working on these floating docks they used to make. And my mother, as I say, was up in Melton Mowbray with the younger ones. I was only 12 at the Battle of Britain, and kind of when it finished, I mean, I wasn't much more than 14, 15. Anything to do with the war, I didn't have anything really to do with it. Only run away from the buzz bombs. Because after the Battle of Britain, that's when we used to get the V1s over, which you probably recognise them. They were like a plane with a flame coming out the back of them. And as soon as the flame went out, then it would come straight down. And of course, you never knew where it was going to go. Especially like Afghanistan, where all that bombing is going on. I feel so sorry for them people, innocent people. But that's just exactly what we used to go through during the war. The Second World War, exactly the same thing. You'd come over and drop bombs, you never know where they were going to go, you never knew if your number was coming up. Or whether you'd go out in the morning from the air raid shelter, you just hope that your house is still standing. Because a lot of people would come out them shelters, go home, and there's nothing. It was all down to the ground, gone.
Do you think that war is ever justified?
Personally, no. I think it's just a load of politicians, a load of politics all to do with it.
Have you ever known any politicians to send their own children to war?
Personally, no. I suppose there have been, but I don't know of any. I'd hate to go through it again. I'd hate my grandchildren and great-grandchildren to go through it. Being through it myself is enough. And to see younger people going before their parents, terrible thought. As you see, my wife Elizabeth is my second marriage. Her grandchildren now are my grandchildren. And we have just had one grandson, just finished his term in Afghanistan and just returned. So we're pretty proud of him. He's just returned as a major. He's done his term and got home safely. So we're really proud about that. I can remember when the Spitfires used to fly along the side of what they used to call the doodlebugs, which is like a little plane with a flame coming out the back, which was governed on flight by what they call a gyro. Well, the Spitfires used to fly alongside of them and just tip the wing, try to knock the gyro off a compass, though it would turn and go back out to sea. That used to be quite a sight to sit and watch that thing happening. My hat goes off to all them flyers and everybody that made a Battle of Britain and got through it as safe as we did. And Winnie, as we used to call him, Winston Churchill, we used to call him Winnie. He had another saying too. He said, give us the job, the tools, and we'll finish the job. And they did. So we're pretty proud people right now.
My name is Tony Hennig. My other story, well, when I was going to Great Britain to join the Air Force, I was on a boat called Empress of Canada. And we were going from South Africa, from Durban, all the way to Southampton to join the Air Force. But halfway through, some unfriendly submarine shot some terrible things towards us and torpedoed us. So we spent about 48 hours swimming around, and then came another Air Force company flying over, which was the Catalina. And if you ever look at the Nanaimo airport, there is one of those Catalinas sitting there, the number 9. Well, we had another one there before, and that other one is already gone to England. That's why I went to England to visit them. That's the kind of war experience one goes. It's very difficult to isolate one segment of one's experience from the others, because it is all a continuous story. Today I sit here with you enjoying this wonderful company, especially my good friend here, Gord Bell, who made all the arrangements. Oh yes, this is true. I enjoy the freedom of speaking, freedom of living where I do, privilege of living in this wonderful country with a Canadian passport. And you know, I appreciate that very much, because the war, it was the Battle of Britain that decided whether or not we are really free today, as opposed to being countries where you cannot speak your language or go to school or go to church. And I think a lot of people are still oblivious to the fact, you know, they take it so much for granted that what they have here today. So I pay a great tribute to my friends who are no longer with us. I have lost a lot of friends during the war. They didn't make it. I often think about them and say an odd prayer because, you know, those were the guys who gave everything they had, their lives. Battle of Britain celebration day, we ought to remember them and not to forget that they were the real battlers, you know. They didn't make it because war can be pretty cruel, but they did their best. I even brought here later to show you my logbook as a pilot, because sometimes people ask a question, you know, what did you fly? Where did you fly? I usually proudly display it. When you're young, beginning to fly, that's how you look, you see, rather young, inexperienced pilot. And then later on, you meet with buddies, about 3 or 4 of these already gone forever. I thought I'd let you know what kind of Spitfires I flew, just very briefly. I had the Tiger Moth, Master, Harvard, and Spitfire. And in the RAF, it is compulsory to keep your record of all your flying, minutes and hours, and the names of those who were with you. So here you are. One of the notes here is about flying the machines that were stationary. They used to call them link trainer, which means that you are sitting in a box with some instruments all covered up, and some pilot outside at the big table is directing you which way to go and searching, making sure that you do it the right way. So there you are. There are some funny parts of, of being in the RAF. I wish some of these people who were there with me could be still alive, because when you come to my age, it's difficult. I am so fortunate to be member of the 808 Wing here in Nanaimo. It's an Air Force Association, and we have mostly members who were in the Air Force or attached to the Air Force activities. We meet here every Friday. And you know, when I look at the faces of all these guys, I say, gosh, we're still around, you know. But 808 Wing has other, of course, purposes. We look after air cadets, who are our future. I just hope that we can manage for a long, long time with the help of the wing here. In fact, if you go out there to the corridor, you may find some photographs of the past presidents and others who contributed well to this organization. Most of them could tell you stories that I'm not even able to tell you because my Polish is not so good. All I know is that this is a day to remember, and every year people who served or who were witnessing the Battle of Britain, we meet. And we have a wonderful, wonderful time. We are meeting and celebrating on September 17th, right here. There will be a wonderful celebration to remember Battle of Britain. And you will find a lot of people, like myself, maybe even carrying an old flag, you know, to remind people that it was worth remembering. And I hope that it will never happen again, but who knows. Anyway, that's all I can tell you in this brief moment, in this brief interview. And I appreciate the fact that the Radio Malaspina found time and willingness to talk with us. This I appreciate very much, because you have a lot of these young fellows, young people there in Malaspina, who probably will appreciate hearing some of the memories that we just expressed in here. May I simply say that it was a great pleasure of meeting you, and I would like to thank you for taking your time. This is very much appreciated, so thank you very much.
In Alan Cabo, yeah, I was a second officer in the Blue Funnels line, and their ships, of course, were so well known in the early days as more or less a part of Liverpool. But during the war there, I was lucky. I was one of the lucky ones that never got my feet wet, and thank goodness for that. I was home from sea at the time that the Liverpool was blitzed. This went on day after day for a month. You could almost time them coming over in masses. I was living in an area which was probably 3 miles away from the river, and we didn't get any of the heavy stuff, but on the Liverpool docks they really took a hammering. There was one ship, a Brocklebank ship, that was loaded with ammunition and just went up in smoke. Needless to say, it took a lot of other stuff with it. In the houses, the ordinary house, I'm not talking about some of these fancy ones, but a strong point was under the stairs. That's where you used to congregate, and there was stray stuff that came down that gave you something to think about. One friend of mine, who was an apprentice Liverpool pilot, a sea pilot, he was standing at a corner, and I forget the name of the corner now, but one came down from him, and that was the end of him. There were so many people that had to be salvaged, put it that word, and the blitzes usually went on for 3 or 4 hours, and then when you got the all clear, it was a treat to get out of the shelter and just go and see what damage had been done in the area. Thank you.
Victim Mentality, A State of Mind by Pam Edgar. I know what a victim is. I've been one. I've survived an accident that left me scarred and disfigured, to be resembled to an act of war by a World War II vet. We had a great conversation on a sunny summer day while our vehicles were being maintained. A chance meeting, a moment in time. He said my leg looked like I had stepped on a landmine. I told him I was sitting on a motorbike that was hit by a car. He put his hand on my kneecapless knee and smiled at me a victory smile that still brings tears to my eyes. A victim is a survivor of trauma. The trauma can be somewhat individual. Different straws for different camels. If you think an emotional trauma doesn't have a physical effect or the other way around, you'd be mistaken in my experience. The gentleman vet reminisced that he had traveled halfway across the globe to witness this kind of injury. I reminisced that I only needed to travel about a mile south of where we sat. I told him shyly that I refer to my scars as war wounds. The war between the Honda and the Pontiac. I was the casualty. He straightened, broadened, shone with pride and called them medals of honor, and added, "You wear them well." I know what it is to be a victim. I also know what it is to be victimized. I have had that experience within my own country, by means of both provincial and federal levels. You might as well throw in municipal as well. Then there is the personal aspect of being a victim, and that aspect uses guilt as a weapon. When I've treated myself like a victim by allowing myself to be victimized by a situation, I haven't been the only casualty. Even when my battles have been internal, there has been cause and effect. When I realized much of what I was going through was self-inflicted, I got stronger by taking my personal responsibility back, no longer blaming anyone or anything. I took on the attitude of, okay, this is what I have to deal with it, and start doing something. If a person treats themselves as a victim by disregarding personal responsibility, by blaming fault to others for their situation, there will be casualties. The victim victimizes by means of guilt, force, and sometimes intimidation. The victimized are more often big-hearted, generous folk who just want to help. They become a victim of circumstance. We all have crosses to bear. We all want to help. We all need to learn to take care of ourselves before we can take care of others. That's what I believe. If you give more of yourself than you have to give, then you haven't taken care. Care has been taken and not given. Don't get me wrong, I still get guilted into things. But things and how much they cost me are up to me. I exercise some of that personal responsibility by pumping up my use of the word no. No, it's not my fault that I was hit by a car, or have multiple sclerosis, or that cancer runs in my family. But it's not your fault either.
Hello, Bob Rudolph. Thanks Hi. For joining me today.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And where are you living exactly? Where am I calling you right now?
You're calling me in Steilacoom, that's Steilacoom, Washington, in Washington State.
Okay.
Just near Tacoma, Washington is the nearest place, big town.
And we met in Victoria recently. You had no trouble getting across the border?
No, not a bit.
You like visiting Canada?
Oh, I love it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place.
Have you always lived in the United States?
I was born in New York City, upstate New York, but I went into service at 17, and I lived different places around. I spent 9 years, nine years in the U.K.
Oh, yeah.
In the military, and I've also spent time in Korea and other places around the States.
You've been involved in active combat, active war?
I was in during the Vietnam era. I had orders to go to Vietnam, and they got canceled. And they sent me to England instead, and I didn't cry too much about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, to answer your question, I never really had to serve in combat, but I was in during the whole Cold War, which I think helped keep our world much safer over that period.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about war?
Don't like it. I think if we are at war, I think we have failed. War should be the very last resort whenever it goes to fix a dispute. I think it should be done by diplomatic means every way possible. Like I say, when you go to war, I think the countries have failed.
Do you think then that so-called wars that are going on are frivolous in the present time?
I think this war in Iraq is a catastrophe. We have over 2,600 wonderful, brave young men and women who have been killed. We've got over 20,000 seriously injured, losing limbs, legs, arms, really literally faces, their mind. I think it's a terrible thing to go to a war like this as a war of choice.
It does seem to be a war of choice more than of necessity, doesn't it?
Yes, it's absolutely right. It was a war of choice to have our young people over there and to be killing hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqi people who have done nothing to us.
So this is a huge concern because it's as if their blood is not as valuable as ours.
Well, it's every bit as valuable as
well,
ours.
Well, yeah. I haven't seen the movie that was made about the September 11th event. If something like that is going to be made, there could well be a movie, a similar kind of movie portraying the effect on the community in Iraq, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not even going to go see that movie, to be honest with
no.
you. I think I've seen enough of it on the news, and we know what it's about. And mm-hmm. I am from New York. I can identify with a lot of that.
Sure.
I feel terrible for those people. But to have a government use that as a pretext to go to war against a country who had nothing to do with that is disgusting and outrageous, and so I just can't do it.
How long have you been involved with Veterans for Peace, and can you tell us a bit about what that organization is doing?
I started off at Veterans for Peace probably 3 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, it's a national organization. We've got over 5,000 members.
Okay.
We're up to chapter, I think, about 146 now, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a local thing here. It's a national organization. We've just had our 20th anniversary for Veterans for Peace. Well, I started off in the Olympia chapter, which, by the way, is named the Rachel Corey chapter. And Rachel Corey, of course, is the young lady who was bulldozed in Palestine by the Israeli bulldozer, if you might remember, several years ago. And her dad is one of the founders of the chapter in Olympia, Craig Corey, and her mom. So we know them very well. I was there for a couple of years, and then we started our own chapter here in Tacoma, and I am currently the vice president of that chapter. What Veterans for Peace, one of our little statements of purpose, what we say is, and I'll just... is that we have dutifully served our nation, and we have, you know, hereby affirm our greater responsibility to serve the cause of world peace. To this end, we will work with others and then towards making public awareness of the cost of war, and, you know, try to restrain our government from intervening into the internal affairs of other nations and to end the arms race. And one of our big things is to seek justice for veterans and victims of war. We're really, really supporting our troops that are coming home with all these terrible, terrible injuries. The other thing, of course, is, and as I was kind of alluding to earlier about we have failed, is to abolish war as an instrument of our national policy.
Hmm.
Many of us have served from World War II all the way through this latest conflict. And so a lot of these fellows and women have actually served in combat, and they know what they're saying.
Do you feel like Veterans for Peace is able to support the returning troops in a more positive and complete way than the government is?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm proud to say our chapter from the Rachel Corey chapter from Olympia, Washington, managed through a lot of hard work with our state government to finally get our National Guard troops from Washington State got a bill passed where they will now all be tested for the effects of depleted uranium when they come back.
Wow.
We're trying to make that a national issue.
Mm-hmm.
And because depleted uranium, I look at that as the Agent Orange of this particular war, where
yeah.
people coming back that are terribly, terribly hurt by the depleted uranium. When we're doing that, our chapter, we started a thing we call a Comfort Cafe, which we're, as we find vets that have come back and need to talk about the war that, you know, that a lot of times I think, well, I can't talk to my family because they won't understand. I've got a coffee shop here in Tacoma that graciously given us a room and the discounts on coffee where we as vets can talk to some of these young people and help them work through their issues and problems from what they've seen and done and try to help get them back into society a little bit easier.
I mean, it must be a huge enough shock to be in that situation, and even more dire when you come back into the community here and it's not at all like how you were when you left.
You're not the same person.
No.
You're completely different. You've seen and done things
yeah.
that an 18, 19, I don't care if you're a 100-year-old person
sure.
is not meant to see and do, and our bodies and our minds
mm-hmm.
are not geared for that
no.
kind of thing. So it's a terrible thing. We've also got a thing we call Toys from the Heart, which my wife and I started, but we have included in our Veterans for Peace chapter. And my wife and I, and now Veterans for Peace, we have sent tens of thousands of small toys, cuddly toys and things to the Iraqi children through the chaplains on the bases at in Iraq, and we're expanding into Afghanistan. These are things that these kids can have something they can sort of cuddle and hold on to and try to work it from that angle rather than trying to blow somebody up. We're trying to spread our love and peace around the world.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, that's a really nice initiative. How many have you sent over? Do you have any idea?
I know it's in the thousands. I say it's in the tens of thousands. We've been doing this ever since the war first started.
Oh.
So when I've got right now in my basement in the garage, I've probably got another several thousand to send that we're getting ready to box up here now.
Wow. Do you have a contact over there, or who do you deal with?
We work with the chaplains. There's a chaplain here at the Air Force Base is not far from us here, and he's going to Iraq, and I've already talked to him, the chaplain, and he's going to be our contact over there.
Wow. Have you been to Iraq yourself?
No, I have not. I do have a family member. My son-in-law is currently in the Army, and he was sent to Iraq when it first started. He went to, he went to through Kuwait, and then in the initial, I hate this term, but shock and awe.
Right.
He was in that push in 101st Airborne. He's been home and for, a couple of years, and he's heading back out in December, either to Iraq or Afghanistan for another 18 months. It's a terrible thing.
Yeah, it's sort of a blend. I mean, it sounds like you support people if they choose to go. It's kind of an interesting blend, I think, that you support people if they choose to go and when they come back. It's almost like there isn't judgment. There's just care and concern and wanting to do the best you can with a pretty extreme situation.
That's true. I know we've been out and protesting the war, of course, and doing different things. And again, many of us are, all of us are vets. And yet I've been called by people who have not served and have gone by me in their cars, and I've been called a traitor and should be ashamed of myself, and the usual stuff, anti-American, all the epithets you can think of, and some I can't say here on your radio show. And then I'll ask you, well, thank you very much. Have you served? And where have you served? Oh, I haven't. I said, well, I served for 20 years. I think I have the right to do this. And how dare we send our troops to a place to try to say that freedom is on the march, and that you people don't want us to have the freedom here to speak our mind.
I think that is one of the biggest fallouts of this whole last few years, is seeing the freedoms of our country stripped away, like Canada and the States. Seems like in order to protect ourselves, we have to put ourselves behind bars.
Mm-hmm. And having said what I've said here today, I love my country, and I fought for it, so to speak, during the Cold War for 20 years. I really resent anyone taking away my right to freedom of speech and to say what I want. As I think it was Theodore Roosevelt said, that if you should always be able to, and I'm paraphrasing, but you should always be able to speak about your country or criticize it, especially in the time of war. If you don't, that is tantamount to treason.
Wow. Oh, that's a good turn. Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but the words are pretty darn close.
Mm-hmm. What is that quote you have on your email?
People will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. I should have put a quote there from somebody. I just happened to see it one time. I thought, boy, that's what a powerful quote that is.
It's very true. And
it's so powerful. I use it, and if I can ever find where it came, maybe I'll have to go try to Google it, and I'll put whoever else on there and make sure I put them as a quote from that person. I think it's a wonderful quote.
Yeah, I like it.
And I think that's true in everything we do, including these things going on today, and I think you can say that to our military folks. And I think, honestly, you can say this in the international setting. We can say all the rhetoric that we want, how good we are around the world, but what people are going to do is see what we've done, how we made them feel.
That really stretches it into the bigger picture.
Yep. So I think that kind of fits into the whole aspect of what's going on in our world today.
What would you say is the most common refrain of the troops coming home that you've had the opportunity to speak with?
Many of them are there, and they really don't know what they're there for. They are very much against what they're doing. We've talked to a lot of young fellows and women that have come back, and they are very, I guess I'll say, angry and upset because they really don't think we ought to be there, and we don't even know what the cause is that we are there for. What is the noble cause that we're there for? They're just over there because the government sent them. And the same thing happened in Vietnam. Many people went to Vietnam. They went over there with the, gung-ho, I'm going to go over and do this because I was asked to do this. And once they got there, they thought, why are we even here? There's no cause to be there for. And the same thing is happening today.
This is Jeff Healy, and you are in the middle of Living on Purpose with Lynn Thompson.
How is your organization, Veterans for Peace, able to help them deal with that confusion?
You have to do it on a case-by-case basis, mm-hmm. and we have sat with the young people and sat down with them. I've been called 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to sit down and let them just talk. A lot of the ways that we handle that, quite frankly, is let them talk, vent, and then we respond when we think we need to say something. I kind of look at it as you went over there and served your country, and which they have. They went over there and under their country's banner to serve their country. We try to just talk to them. Again, it depends on the situation, and let them know that it's a terrible thing, and we just have to be able to work out those problems with them. It's hard to really generalize on a conversation or on how you can deal with it, because it depends so much on the individual and how they are working this out or not working out within their own mind. So it's just a case-by-case basis.
Do you think there's ever been a war in the world that's been justified?
I think World War II was justified. I'm not sure about World War I. But I do think at the time we did have a reason to do that. I don't think, quite frankly, in our country's history, I mean, of course, the Revolutionary War, things like that, the Civil War wasn't, I mean, that was a terrible, terrible thing in our country. And I don't think the Korean War, the Vietnam War, or this war were justified.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell people this. I mean, if it was a war that was to protect my country, old as I am, I would go back in, or I would be a sitter here at a base here, and while other people could go, of course, I would give my life for my country, but not for something like this. This is not protecting our country at all.
What do you think is the reason for this war?
Various reasons. You know, these people keep talking about oil as far as cheap oil, whatever. I think when it comes to the petroleum products, I think we want to be able to have a lock on the world. So as supplies get short, we do have a hold over these countries that have oil. I also think we want to put bases in Iraq, which we all know that they're building now, to give us that stranglehold, however you want to call it, in that part of the world. I think it's to give us a presence there and those kind of things. I think it's all those things and much more. I just think that it's all part of a big plan to put our influence, sphere of influence, in many places around the world that we haven't had that much influence before.
Yeah. It seems to me that the whole situation has been becoming much more transparent. I'm wondering about the whole concept of dying bravely when, in fact, quite often soldiers are killed or seriously injured in the line of duty, as it's called, but in very obscure and sort of accidental circumstances. The whole idea of a hero, like, what does a hero mean in your mind?
You're going to ask me something really tough there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, a hero does not have to be, in the sense of the word, I don't think, in the military. I mean, I think a firefighter that goes in and brings somebody out is a hero. I think a policeman that goes and saves some child's life or someone's life as a hero. I think in the military, if we have a soldier that helps save his soldiers' lives and helps his mm-hmm. soldiers survive through this terrible war, that person is a hero. I think that's how I look at a hero, that puts himself on or herself on the line to help bring back our kids safely and hopefully in one piece. I think that's what a hero is. It's not just some guy that's a person that's in the military shooting all the people he can shoot or she can shoot.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole thing is to bring our people back and get them back safely.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what a hero is more about. If someone goes in there and saves a bunch of Iraqi people, for example, from something that's going on that isn't right, I think that person's a hero.
Sure.
That's kind of how I look at it. I don't look at it maybe in the traditional sense of the big war hero that's charging up a hill, you know, and that thing. I think try to bring his people home or her people home as safely as they can.
I think that's a fair description. You know, you have images of glory and riding up the hill.
Well, that's a lot different than what you see in the movie or a video game.
Yeah.
When you finally get out there and do something and see what's going on, it's a scary, scary place to be.
And, yeah, as you say, it's making the difference and stepping out to help other people in a dire situation.
Right.
What proportion of women are coming back? How many women are in the troops?
I can't give you proportions, but there are a lot of, I don't know, I'm going to say 20% possibly are women.
Okay.
I don't know if that's official figures.
Okay.
See, a lot of women that are here that have served in Iraq and in Afghanistan, for that matter. Matter of fact, I talked to a woman today. We went to a meeting for our reelecting of our senator, Maria Cantwell, who's a Democrat fighting for our troops. And I talked to a lady there whose daughter is in Iraq, as a matter of fact, and we're all praying that she gets home safely. One thing that we have found, I did talk to some ladies here in Tacoma a while back, and it appears that, I don't know if it's the female function or what of the body, but a bunch of those ladies that are coming back have come down with MS or MS-type symptoms.
Hmm.
You know, it could be depleted uranium
right.
or some chemicals, something over there, but there's a lot of them, and they've even got a, I don't know what it is right now, but they've got a support group on a website. Not like one or two, it's quite a few that have come back from the first Gulf War and are coming back from this one with the same problems. So it's some extent, medically, it's affecting some of the women different than the men in that respect. All the other things are the same as far as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and all
sure.
the rest of those things. But I think there's also some problems probably inherent in the female anatomy, you know, that
yeah, that's interesting.
Happen.
Yeah. You find that it's mostly people who haven't served and maybe don't know people who are in the war that are against Veterans for Peace?
I think most people think if you're a Veterans for Peace, you're some kook out of the 60s, you know, sort of, you know, the old...
Right.
And you've seen me. I'm bald-headed, and you know I'm retired after working for almost 50 years.
Yeah.
But we've been in things here, and I've been told to wash, get a haircut, get a job from people that have no idea what they're talking about, most who have never served. And again, all of us folks at Veterans for Peace, and I'm also in a group called Vets for Vets and a bunch of other things that help the troops, have no idea what they're talking about. And they're the ones that are calling us names. Most of those have never served. And there are some that have served that are so blinded by this, what I call blind patriotism. They call it patriotism, I don't, but this blind obedience that whatever you're told to do, you go off and do. Well, there are some times that's not necessarily appropriate.
Off the top of your bald head.
Thank you very much.
What would you, how many people would you say you've talked to? How many of
hundreds.
The returning troops? Yeah.
Hundreds, because we have two military installations right around us.
Right.
And I talked to a lot of the young people. And hey, when I was in, and I was in, as I said, during the Vietnam era, you had a, obviously you're in, you don't talk about things, you just press on with what you're told to do.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these young people will say things that they don't dare say around the military, because the ones that are in, because they're afraid they might get themselves thrown out or chastised for it. So a lot of these young troops are very, very wary of what they say, especially in the official sense. And I know we have been to many funerals for these young people, Fort Lewis and other cemeteries around, and so many of these kids, they went in at 18 and were watching be buried at 19.
Wow.
And they went in to get an education or to get health care, which a lot of these kids
right.
come from the poorer families, quite frankly, because they couldn't get a job and they want to get out of the particular neighborhood or situation they're in. So it's the old thing, oh, go in the military. So they're going in to better themselves, help their families.
Yeah.
And so I look at this, I call this an economic draft. Even though there is no official draft, but there's a backdoor draft for these folks that they're doing the stop loss on. They're making them stay longer against their own free will.
That's true.
And these kids that are going in, like I say, from these poorer neighborhoods, and not necessarily just black kids, but, you know, black, white, anything, any economically disadvantaged group of people, it doesn't matter what they are. They're going in to get a better life, and then they end up over in Iraq, and they come back without legs and without arms or dead. And
yeah.
We've seen some of the families, and one poor lady, she couldn't even, when it was a cold day out in the fall, she couldn't even, when they went to bury him, she couldn't even, she says, no, it's too cold, too dark, he can't go in there,
aww.
Can't bury him. She wouldn't accept the flag. It was people that are for this war need to go and see some of this, see some of the despair that these poor families are going through when they come back and they bury an 18-year-old, 19-year-old child. It's just horrendous. And I think people that are this gung-ho and they're running around here with a 9-foot SUV and a 15-foot flag there saying how patriotic they are, let them go see some of these families that are grieving terribly for their children.
Do you think a lot of the parents initially support the children, and do you think that some of them still support the fact that they went even if they do come back dead or injured?
I support my son-in-law. He's in. He's my grandchildren's dad. And of course I support him. I don't support the mission he's on. These people we've talked to, I don't like to use the word these people in that sense, but the people that we talk to, of course they've supported their loved one that went to war. This lady today we talked to, whose daughter's there, and many of them we talked to are violently against the war, but they support their young person who's there. Some of them are very, very bitter that they've lost a loved one in the war. They're very, very bitter, very upset and angry. Then there are some that, and I'll be very honest with you, when we go to these funerals, of course, we don't go there as anything other than respecting and holding up these families.
Yeah.
And we're sorry for your loss, you know, and all those things, which are true. And a lot of people, I think the only way they can get through the grief is to say to themselves that my husband, my son, my brother, whatever, daughter, whatever it happens to be, wife, died for a noble cause, and they died for their country. They use that as a way to get through that, that there was an honorable circumstance. To be fair, that the person died for their country, not necessarily that the war was honorable, but they gave their life for their country, and I think a lot of parents and family members have to use that to get through this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's kind of almost a double-edged sword. They really, just their way to cope.
Do you care to comment on some of these other activities that are going on? What do you think about what they're trying to accomplish?
I support some of the things Cindy Sheehan's doing. I mean, how do I say this? We've been to Washington, D.C., and we have seen her and listened to her, and there's also a woman from Scotland who was in the same boat, whose son was killed like hers, but from the British military.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not dancing around this thing.
No, that's fine.
But what I'm going to say is I appreciate and I understand a lot of what Cindy Sheehan does. I think she hurts her cause if she's trying to bring over people sort of in the middle of the country, in the middle of the political spectrum, when she goes and hangs out with Chavez down in Venezuela and with Putin and with Castro and people like that. I think she hurts the cause. She has every right to do that, but I think when she goes and she tries to get these people, when you're trying to pull over a segment of society, when they see you hanging around with those groups of people, I think that hurts your credibility to some of the people. If you're way over on the left, it makes you look like a great, but if you're kind of in the middle and you want to kind of bring those people over, we're going to have a hard time doing that when she does these things. I applaud what she's doing for the most part. I just don't think that she needs to be seen with some of the people that she's dealing with around the world.
Wasn't aware of that.
And I just think those things are a little bit, you look like a hero, so to speak, to your own, you're preaching to the choir, and that's fine. Those guys think you're great. But the other people, you got to bring over other people and bring them to your side. And if you can't do that, then you're not going to win anything. You got to play your cards a certain way to do that.
You've used interesting metaphors, violently against war and double-edged sword.
Yes, very interesting metaphors. And I'm not sure my vocabulary.
I guess it's understandable, you know, because of the kinds of things that you're thinking about. Those images would come up.
Well, that's true, and they're not very peaceful images, are they, when you think about it? But I'm not sure how else to say that so that you can really make your feelings known and how vigorously one feels about these issues and get it out, and hopefully people will understand I'm still a man of peace. But sometimes when you use the word double-edged sword or violently disagree with something, you don't mean it really in that sense of the word.
I'm trying to think of peaceful images that would be as strong, you know.
Well, can you name me one?
I'm trying to think. Let's see if I come up with anything.
But I think most people know what we're really saying. I think they do. I hope they do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could be violently against war. Yeah, my wife just said adamantly against war.
Adamantly.
Adamantly for peace.
Adamant's a good word. Stubbornly persistent.
Yes.
Did you ever hear of Peace Pilgrim, who walked back and forth across the states?
Yes, Peace Pilgrim?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think it was her. There was someone, anyway, if it wasn't her, who basically was talking about doing things for peace, not against war. You know, like just in terms of turning it around like that.
Right, right. There are a lot of people here working towards a Department of Peace. Some of the braver politicians are coming on board. I think there's 20 or 30 of them now. And when I was in the service, one of the commands that I was in, I think it might have been SAC, Strategic Air Command, was that peace is our profession.
Hmm.
That's another dichotomy. When I was in, our whole object in the military was not, unlike today, where it seems like preemptive war is the rule. When I was in, our whole thing in the military was that we had a strong enough military that it was to not to have to go to war at all. The last thing that a military person wants to do is go to war. And it's supposed to be called the Department of Defense. And if you take that literally, Department of Defense means our military is here to defend us, not to go preemptively off and start wars.
Mm-hmm.
There you go again with the sort of different metaphors and things. But I think my whole thing in the military when I was in, again, was to keep the peace and not to go off and fight. Again, that's a last resort.
What do you think of Canada being traditionally a peacekeeper and now being involved in war?
I respect Canada immensely for being a peacekeeper. I think being a peacekeeper, you talk about heroes earlier on. I think heroes are people that can keep peace also, and I think that's a very, very hard thing to do. And I really respect the folks in Canada for what they do. They are helping us in different areas, and I think sometimes politically they have to do that. I guess I'll say sometimes circumstances can make strange bedfellows, and I think if they can strategically put people like to help us in Afghanistan or to help with a force like with the United Nations force to help us in the Lebanon area or things like that, then I think that's fine because I think it's working towards peace. So I think sometimes you're going to have to do things, maybe if the goal at the other end is peace, maybe sometimes we have to do some things we don't want to do to service that getting of peace.
Mm-hmm.
Canada is actually, quite frankly, I think to a lot of people, and I think probably more in our country than any place else in the world, to underestimate marvelous things that Canada does do towards world peace. There's lots of places that you guys are at working towards peaceful means, especially under the aegis of the United Nations and other peace world bodies, I'll put it that way, that work towards peace. So I respect that a lot.
I guess it would be helpful if we had more coverage of peaceful efforts rather than the war and accident efforts.
Oh, well, I guess it would. It would just show the... See, again, people don't have any idea. The United Nations, I'll just use that as... Think of they're in like 60 or 70 countries around the world, and there's Canadians and all kinds of military folks on those working for peaceful means. They're helping people grow crops and helping all kinds of things and investing in the infrastructure of other countries. To me, in Iraq, if we were over there with a bunch of people building things instead of tearing things down, I think they would be much more with us than they are now.
I think
we need to be working with them to build up the country, not to tear it down. And I think in the whole world, I'd rather spend our money going around the world helping with building projects than I would with troops.
Yeah. And again, speaking about, you know, news reports of peaceful efforts, I think that maybe there just aren't enough alternatives offered to people to consider.
Well, I work with a lot of the school children as well.
Okay.
I work with them. I go around to the schools because a lot of times you have recruiters in schools.
Right.
You know, I'm not fond of that. But we go around then as the Veterans for Peace or some other peace groups that I belong to. I take alternatives to the schools.
Oh, good.
In other words, you got the recruiters there saying, you know, join the military and all those things for all the various reasons. But I have a table there, and my table, I have things on Job Corps. I have articles on Peace Corps. Talk to them about the VISTA and AmeriCorps and the Peace Corps to go overseas to work with other people. All kinds of different things, different kinds of college scholarships they can get. So kind of along the line what you're talking about, I do work with the kids to get them and say, hey, there are other ways to get education, to get health care, and to do things. And also, if you're interested in going overseas, hey, you don't have to go into the military. You can go in the Peace Corps. So we do work with the young people because part of our No Child Left Behind Act in this country for the schools is that when a kid is 16, 17, 18 years old, their names are given to the government, and they go into a big data bank, and then they give them out, and then the recruiters can get those names, and they go out to these kids and try to get them to go into the military. And a lot of these kids don't realize that there is a form you can fill out every year that says they cannot give your name.
Oh, really?
For this purpose. What I'm getting at is this whole thing, I think, works into the peace process in that instead of using the military as a tool for the educational needs and things of our children, we can show them peaceful ways of doing that and also working overseas, like I say, to help others and they represent their country, of course, overseas, but it's more in a peaceful means than it is in a war-type situation.
Do they still get the benefits if they're working at that aspect of it? The lures that they have about the education and medical benefits?
Oh, well, yeah, the educational things, of course, like when they, for example, if they sign up to work in AmeriCorps, they get paid. And in AmeriCorps, what you do is You can go work as a teacher's aide. You can go work mm-hmm. in the forest to help replenish the forest. Any kind of a civic activity,
mm-hmm.
then you get paid then by the government. Bill Clinton started this, by the way.
Oh, okay.
And you get paid by the government. It's not a lot, but they give you a stipend of about $7,000 to $8,000 a year while you're working and learning, doing whatever it is that you're, which specific pursuit you're in.
Mm-hmm.
You get that per month, plus they'll pay for a year of college for you. You can do that twice, so they can go in and get their education and get paid while they're doing it, and also doing a service and learning how to work with people.
Now, how does this work out? How many people come back and are able to follow through on that education? Do you have any idea?
I have not had any follow-up on it yet.
That'd be really interesting to know.
Keep notes, and I can actually tell you the truth. I can get back with you when I get some follow-up on that.
Yeah, I mean, because that's a big part of the perk about the whole situation, I would be curious to know how many are able to do that mentally, physically.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that I do along with that same thing, on occasion a young man or woman said, well, I really do want to go in the military. And I don't try to talk them out of it. When they come up to me at the school, I'll say, we have this and that, and we can do this and whatever you want. We have a diving, one of the best D.C. diving schools in the world is in Seattle, so I have things for that. The point I'm getting at is, if they want to go in the military, what I tell them is, if you're really bound and determined to do that, that's fine. But when you go talk to the recruiter, and if he has some things or she has some things that you don't understand, come back to me. You know, I'm here a couple of times a month at your school,
mm-hmm.
and we'll go over all this material and make sure that you understand what you're getting into before you go in.
Oh, that's good.
I think you have to do that, because some people just want to go in the military, and that's fine. I'm not against the military. I had 20 years of, I thought it was a good life in the military, and I don't begrudge it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just with administrations like we're having at this point in time, you got to really watch these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And recruiters are saleswomen.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to sell them a bill of goods just to get them in. So we need to be careful and make sure that these kids understand exactly what they're signing up for. And one of the first things I ask them is, if you're going to go in, are you willing to kill or be killed? The recruiter is not going to ask them that. And I tell them, this is not a video game. This is real.
Now, what do you think about these video games? I was just going to ask you that.
I think some of these video games are horrendous. And as a matter of fact, when the Army recruiters go around, they give out video games.
Really? Oh, dear.
And then that kind of helps suck them in.
Well, how blatant is that?
It's very blatant. See, and that's where I'm saying some of these kids that have never had a whole lot, all of a sudden they see this and they give them all the glamorous part. And
yeah.
Then in about 2 months, they're sitting over in Baghdad somewhere is getting shot at.
Dead is dead. It isn't
Absolutely.
Just a game. Yeah.
And a lot of kids, you know, we all did probably, that you don't really think about that. And you don't really realize that, hey, those bullets are live. There's no kidding around out there.
Mm-hmm. It's like taking one of those games where you're driving through traffic at a high speed, you know,
right.
You're just sitting there safely in some mall or something.
Yep,
but
it's a lot different than being out on the freeway.
What would you say your living on purpose aspect is of your involvement with Veterans for Peace?
I would say probably the biggest thing that we could do is if we could finally get the government, our government and other governments, quite frankly, to work more towards negotiating and working on a governmental level in peaceful means, and try to work things out peacefully and not have to go to war. I know there probably comes a time when you have certain tyrants and things that sometimes there's only one way to get rid of those type people. I hate to sound like that as a peace guy. But overall, the biggest goal for me is if we could get it where we could stop war as an instrument again of negotiations. It should be a peaceful, try to work with people. If people are downtrodden and need help, then we should be in there with whatever technology we have, whatever we can do funding-wise to go in there and help them build up what they need and help them get up on, you know, get them up to speed as a, in whatever area they need it. I think we need to just work with people as a peaceful, caring country and not as a bully around the world trying to bully our way into places.
Yeah, work more like a team, perhaps,
on a
planet.
Absolutely, yeah. We're all countries here, we're all on this planet, we all need to survive. It'd be a much better place if we could all work together to keep it that way, and just think what we could accomplish in the world. Just think of the things that we could do in discoveries and medical care and all different things to make the people better.
Yeah.
And also the environment better, make us the whole planet healthier.
That's sort of a looking forward with hopefulness answer. I'm wondering also how your life has been affected by becoming a veteran for peace. Very busy.
Very busy.
Yeah.
Out doing things and working these projects that I have mentioned. Like I say, I've had vets call me at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. My wife and I'll go over and talk to them, or they're The guy is having problems with him and his wife, and there's nothing worse than a domestic dispute, but you go in there and you sit with both of them and talk to them and separate them and try to get things. A lot of this comes from post-traumatic stress disorder, from being in a war.
Yep.
So we work hard, very hard for these young people. Until we can get to the peaceful mode, at least try to help these young people when they come back to assimilate back into society, try to have them go off and have a decent life with their own families. We do a lot of that. We do a lot of, like I say, the mother projects. We're just on the go all the time between going to the funerals and all these projects. When you saw me in Victoria, we actually, I hate to say this, but we're retired, and we had to literally schedule ourselves a five-day vacation.
Mm-hmm.
When you're retired, it should always be a vacation. We're very busy with what we do.
You and your wife work as a team this
Absolutely.
Way? Absolutely. She's been involved all along?
Oh, yeah. There's two kind of memberships in Veterans for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is a military veteran membership.
Okay.
The other one is an associate membership. Not like the old-fashioned ladies auxiliary where they go out there and do cooking and stuff while the men are doing their thing. The only difference here is an associate versus a member, military member, is that they just can't hold the president, vice president, those couple offices. Other than that, that's completely equal status. There's no, and so we all work as equals and team leaders and partners, and we work together to get things done. There is no difference. We're all there,
mm-hmm.
whether you're male or female, if you're an associate. You know, whatever. As long as you're looking, as long as you want to work towards peace, you're with us and we're working with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole object. It doesn't matter what you are. It doesn't matter politically, quite frankly. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. If we have the same goals, want to work towards peace, I think the Veterans for Peace is above and beyond all that other stuff. We just want to work towards the same goals.
I think it's really commendable to be doing as much as you can, given your energy and time. And I was just reflecting here that after the Vietnam War, apparently there were more vets from the Vietnam War who committed suicide than actually died in the war.
That's correct. Actually, you mentioned suicide, and from what I've read, that the suicide rate of this war is higher than any war we've had of people that are actually in service or that have gotten out.
Oh, even while they're over there, they feel like that's the only way for them to get out.
Some of them.
Oh, dear.
Because, again, I don't think the human mind is made to see these things and do these things.
Yeah.
And what happens is, I think, when they're going in the military, part of the training is to dehumanize
right.
the enemy. I'll give you just a quick example.
Sure.
Our son-in-law, when he came back from his first tour in Iraq, he came back like a, we call it mid-tour leave.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying how he worked. They worked with the Iraqi people, you know, met some people and got some nice friends, and they worked on the base or the post, whatever, and all this stuff. You know, and he left and went back. When he came back, when he was finished, they were all no good. They were all terrible. They were this, that, and everything else. They were all against us, and all of a sudden, they were dehumanized.
Wow.
And I could see that as clear as a bell within that 6 months.
Wow, that would be a huge mental split, wouldn't
it? Oh, sure. Later on, when you get out of that sort of environment, how do you equate that to anything human? Or how do you say to yourself, that couldn't be me. I couldn't do something like that, but you did.
And then how do you come back into the community and society that
right.
you started from and try to pull together your mind to not have those suspicions or that disassociation
yep,
from people?
You have to try to reconcile that if
mm-hmm.
you can't. And
mm-hmm.
I know we would go out here and there'd be a loud noise and he'd be in the car with me and he'd be almost ducking and everything. You know? These, a lot of these kids, they're just, well, the old world used to be shell-shocked.
Right.
You know, and then it was called, I think, Veterans Heart or something when they were in the Civil War and now it's post-traumatic stress disorder. These kids are never the same, I'll
no.
put it that way. They're
no.
never the same.
Well, Bob, I would really like to know if you can find out how many of them actually are able to go on for that education.
I will work on that.
Mm-hmm.
I need to get a little bit more data before I can do that.
Yeah, for sure. Any final thoughts?
Just appreciate being on, and like I say, just want to make it very clear that I love my country. I fought for it. I am very, very patriotic to my own country. And of course, I love Canada, naturally. But I'm very patriotic to my country, and I just think that as part of my duty as an American and as a former military person, that we really, really question our leadership when it comes time to sending our kids to war. That's the toughest decision a politician has to make, and it should be done with all deliberate care and with the consent of the whole government, not just one or two people.
Perhaps the people in government, if they were willing to send their children, that would set a different example and maybe make them hold off on that decision.
That's absolutely right, and I agree with that 100%.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Bob Rudolph, for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.